everybody. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Patty, how are you today?
I am just fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. I mean, it's a nice July summer day. Not too hot, not too humid. Can't complain.
That's awesome.
We'd like to thank everyone who is a subscriber and or a listener who have joined us today. If you're not subscribed, please consider clicking the subscribe button that's down below. If you like our content, click the thumbs up. And there's also down below a link to our Linktree where you can get all of our Facebook groups, email address, pretty much everything paranormalist related. And with that, I've said my thing. So, what have you got in store for us today?
Man-eating plants.
Oh, not just insect-eating, like Venus flytraps, but you're talking like...
Man-eating plants.
Wow, like 1950s B-movie man-eating
yep.
plants.
All right. So that's what people think about whenever they think about mm-hmm. these carnivorous plants. But I have to tell you, I did a deep dive, and there's a lot of things to know about carnivorous plants. First of all, there's 150 different types of carnivorous plants on this planet. I had no clue.
I didn't either. I know of two. I mean, the Venus flytrap and the pitcher plant. And those are the only two I know.
Yeah. That's what I thought. But I was wrong. And interestingly enough, as I was doing all this deep diving on all this stuff, I found out that the Venus flytrap, there are people who have proposed that it has, it was actually a spore that came on a meteorite and is not natural to this earth because it has no natural predator.
Little shop of horrors. The yep. Audrey too.
And that's not something that a lot of people believe, but it has been posited because it is so very different from most of what we have, but apparently not as different as they think, because altogether there's 150. So we're going to work our way up to some really creepy stories, but I wanted to kind of take us on a tour of these carnivorous plants and bizarre plants that exist. Our first one is called the chicopin tree, and this comes from Japan, and it has unfallen leaves. According to what I understand, it is considered a tree that holds magical spirits and curses. It is not necessarily always a carnivorous tree, but it's interesting. It never loses its bloom. So how it's described is it was a squat tree, and it sat in the middle of this garden in this beautiful, near this beautiful mansion in the 1600s. And the tree had these leaves that came up, and they were 2 inches thick at the base where they attached to the tree, and then came up about 2.5 feet wide and about 4 to 5 feet high. And so they're huge. And it was said that this tree had originally come from China, and that it would whisper and it would talk. And it had these pinkish fruits called jimishi, or human-faced child. They were large pink fruits that literally had ears. It looked like the face of a child.
Oh, that's bizarre.
If someone were to gather it and try to eat it, they describe the flavor of it as a pleasant, sour, sweet flavor. But no one felt comfortable, going after these plants because they literally had eyes, like their eyes were closed, mouths, noses, ears, and they were bizarre. And people would hear voices whispering, and they would say odd little things. Like one of the most cryptic messages that they would often hear is, "We are we are we are in the tree, we are we." And the tree never lost a leaf, never lost a petal. And it sat there for many, many years. The mansion was eventually torn down, and the area became a private fortress, part of a private fortress for a feudal lord. And during that period, the tree still stood. And at one point, the whole area was cleared and made into a park. And it is at that point that the history of the tree stopped. So we don't know what happened to it. There has never been a report of any such tree. And it's described in the literature as fruits that had human faces like baby heads and eyes that looked right at you. If someone was behind the tree, the voice would say, "We are the tree," and it would startle people. There was a doctor who lived in the area who actually wrote journal entries about his experiences with the tree. He had come up behind the tree one day and had heard it talking and came around the other side expecting someone to have been playing a prank. And the fruits, he said, were whispering. He was very rattled by this.
Understandably so, I guess. Yeah.
Now we're going to enter the realm of the trees and the plants that actually do devour beings. All the way up to the last ones will be humans. So I'm going to, there's a plant, and it is huge, I have to tell you. And it is got to be several feet high. It's long purple. It's called the corpse flower. And it's got this, did you ever see it? There's a purple blossom with this long cylindrical whitish yellow center that sticks straight up in the air. Now this plant puts out a scent like a rotting corpse. It stands 9 feet tall from ground to the end of it.
I have seen pictures of that, but I didn't know it was carnivorous.
Yeah. It is. So what it does, the reason it puts out the smell it puts out is that there are animals and there are also insects that are attracted to that scent, you know, the carrion. So it will use the scent to lure them in. And as they come into the plant and get into that sticky center, it catches them and holds them there and digests them.
I don't know much about that, but I thought it only bloomed very, very irregularly.
Yeah. It does, but when it's blooming, that's whenever it puts out that scent, and it's what, that's when it catches some, that's how it gets its food to exist. And then from whatever it absorbs, when it goes dormant, that's what it has until the next feeding.
Hmm. Interesting.
It's a fascinating plant. And they said that this plant's been known to grow as high as 4 inches in a day, a single day. So this thing moves very rapid. And once they get in that, inside that, like that center, like I said, it's got a sticky pollen that holds them inside the, so lizards, mice, small rodents, things like that, even rats, things like that can be trapped in this plant. The Bohan upas is another plant. It comes from Java, and it is much more deadly. It's called the Hydra Tree of Death. And this account I'm going to give you is from a Catholic priest named Friar Jornanson, or Jornanus, J-O-R-D-A-N-U-S, Jordanus, who is from the 14th century. And he talks about this plant with these beautiful vibrant flowers, but when it's in blossom, you know how pollen will come out, you know, like whenever they're fully in bloom? Mm-hmm. It doesn't put out pollen. It puts out a noxious cloud of gas, and it kills whatever's around them. And wow. It's fascinating. And he talks about having seen it in Java and how he had seen the dead animals laying around it. And he didn't know why, but he said he had seen it, and it's a noxious gas. It knocks you unconscious or kills you if you breathe too much of it. So if it knocks you unconscious and you collapse near the plant and you continue to breathe it, you're dead.
Wow, like right out of Star Trek.
Yeah. I know. This is fascinating. In the 18th century, there was a German doctor by the name of J.N. Forscher who claimed in an article that was written in 1783 for the London Magazine that he had collected firsthand accounts of killer trees stationed in the Dutch East Indies as a surgeon. He actually went on an expedition to try to find them, and he said only one of the trees he could find that he knew existed, and it was tucked away in a jungle in this particular area, and he describes it. He said the tree lived up rather high, and it was well known for its deadly reputation. Everything around it was devoid of vegetation, not a single blade of grass, and every animal that entered purportedly was overcome by this noxious fumes, and the area would become steamy like a marshy cavern. Birds who flew into the bleak poisonous zone spontaneously would drop dead in midair. And he said he had come across a hermit who lived in the fringes of this wasteland, who claimed his job, why he was there, living right off the dead zone, if you will, is that he was to attempt to protect the area from innocent people. But his other job was interesting. Local people, when you were sentenced to death, weren't hung or shot or anything like that. They were sent into this area after being given last rites in an attempt to collect the poisonous resin. And they were told if they could do this, that they could avoid the death penalty. He was there to watch. And he said they were given a fairness, a long leather cap, two glasses for their eyes, and an apron that came down as far as their breast, and sturdy gloves. They would venture forward to the tree and try to make it back alive. If they made it back alive, they could go free. And he said the victims died in writhing agony and great contortions. I have seen the tree kill many over the years. I had no idea. I know it's a fascinating. Now, I have to tell you, most of these things are not documented in that there's not a biological sample here today. A lot of these are culled out of the writings of explorers from previous centuries who traveled all around the world. But they were people that, as far as you want to get it, they were pretty reputable. Like they were doctors, or they were scientists, or botanists, or priests, or what have you. And so, their eyewitness testimony on anything else would have been accepted. These are far out stories, very bizarre, many of which appeared in their, not only their journals, but in letters, or later published in newspaper accounts, things of that nature. So it's just really interesting to me that these stories existed, and they exist in context to what these people were doing, where they were going, and why they were there. So we're going to move on to our next one, and it's called the Kumanga Killer Tree. This is the story of a Czech explorer by the name of Ivan Markel in 1998, who was searching for a man-eating tree in Madagascar. Natives thought that the tree was found on a particular part of the island. It had beautiful colorful blooms and this poisonous gas. So he followed their directions and had a guide show them. They got so close, and then they were like, "No, we're not going any further." And so he continued to go on. He said that when they arrived to the area where the killing tree was, that they found no gas spewing from the flowers, but that there were several animal skeletons beneath the tree. The lack of flowers, the native said, was the reason why the tree was not killing. It was not in bloom at that point in time. And he said he actually spoke to a British officer from the area who had photographs of the tree on the island and had various animal skeletons strewn about the base. This was either one of the already talked about trees or a different one. It was really hard to tell because the blossoms were not on it at that time he saw it. So, I mean, it's just fascinating. There's a gentleman who's a captain of a ship. He was an explorer during 1581, and he was in the South Pacific when he records the following event in his journals. He found a man-eating flower. He wrote this in the ship's log. He said it had the brightest petals capable of releasing a sleep-inducing toxin that caused the victim to rest on the petals. Once in the grip of the flower would close over the victim and digest them alive. When he describes it, he says he witnessed this action in this process, and he thought at the time it was the only carnivorous flower ever seen in the world. He calls it the Elbunor, B-A-N-O-O-R. Which means killer or death flower.
Aptly named.
Yeah, they're definitely. Mm-hmm. In Vancouver, Canada, there was a flower called on an island called Dead Man's Island in Canada. There was a huge Native battle there very early on, and so that's why the name of the place. And during this engagement, supposedly there was 200 women and children and elderly people that were captured by the other side and sent to the island demanding an exchange of warriors for the release of these people. The other tribe agreed and handed over the warriors, but the men who had captured the old men and the women and the children were ruthless and massacred the 200 people, left them on the island, hence Dead Man's Island. Now, the story says that because of that, the plants there was a flaming red flowers that grew all across the island. And when the plants grew, they sucked up the blood of the dead, and that it imbued them with this need for blood. And that the petals turned from white to red, and that's how they became flaming red, as if the pulsing with the blood from the hearts of so many valiant men and women who died a needless death. And so it is called Dead Man's Island, and these flame red flowers are there. And if you get close to them, you get very ill. And I just thought it was a fascinating story, and I wanted to bring that concept up about plants drinking blood, because we're going to come across it again later. So this was the first time I bumped into it. So there is a story in Central America of a vicious man-eating tree with long spikes that purportedly impels the victim. If anything or anyone gets near the tree, the spikes, the tree branches with the spikes on, move on their own. The spikes lay down against the bark of the tree and only rise up when there's a victim available. Now, I thought about that, and I thought that's just bizarre. But you know what? A Venus flytrap doesn't open until it senses there's motion around it.
I've never had one of my own.
I had them when I was a kid growing up. Okay. Yeah. And because I thought they were fascinating. So when like a flies fly around, it'll open up wide unless it's digesting and wait for it to land in that sweet, there's a little bit of sweet fluid down in there. So apparently this tree, the points from these spikes would actually rise up and the tree would literally kind of sway until it was able to snag you with some of those spikes, at which point it would just kind of wrap around you, the spikes, stabbing into you and pull you toward it, where you would just hang there bleeding out and it wouldn't let you go. You were just, and the more you thrashed, the more you were caught up in it, like a briar bush, but only on a tree.
Yeah, and most of us thinking of a tree, I mean, we're thinking of, you know, branches. Now, when branches are young, they're pliable. But that would indicate some, you know, especially if they're bigger enough to hold a man or at least a large creature, they're going to be pretty thick in the first place. And just, I'd be fascinated to know what the biological mechanism would be to allow them to move like that.
I honestly don't know, but I have come across several such stories, and I can't, and not that this tree was murderous, but I did, when I was up in Rhode Island one time, go to a place and they had this tree and it was covered in thousands of thorns, supposedly the only one on the North American continent. It was brought back by a traveler, a sea captain, many, many years ago, and it was fascinating. It had thorns easily 2 to 4 inches, depending on which ones, the more mature they were. It was bizarre. And, you know, it just was really interesting to me. So when I thought about that, whenever I read this, and a lot of people call this tree the cannibal tree because it kills people, okay? And the more you, it literally absorbs the blood into the root system and against the trunk. And then whenever there's nothing left to absorb, then it, the spikes with retract and the victim just falls to the bottom of the tree. It says that in 1887, there was a guy by the name of J.W. Buell who, as I said about, he wrote about actually seeing the prey lifted in the air before they were sucked against the tree, and that once their blood was drained, the tree dropped away the remains of the victims.
And you know what's going through my mind when I'm hearing these stories? I mean, are these actual trees, or are these trees, you know, are being manipulated by evil spirits, yeah, other things that we've talked about before, maybe some other things we haven't talked about yet.
But yeah.
You know, what would make something like, especially, you know, you don't find a lot of single specimens of things. You normally find multiple, especially in the tree world. I mean, you go into a forest, you're going to find, clusters of similar types of trees, simply because they, they drop their seeds and they become seedlings and those grow up. And, not all of them do, but I mean, that's typically how things work in a forest. You have replacements for the old trees.
Yep. It's just bizarre. We'll see. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to tell you. I just find it fascinating. There are so many different accounts from so many different people. If you could see one or two, you could say, okay, somebody was hoaxing. They took a little too much, whatever, they drank a little too much that day, whatever it turns out. But in this instance, it isn't that way, because at least it would require a great many people over a great length of time, because we're starting in the 1400s and working our way forward. And only occasionally does somebody come up with something like this. So, it's really interesting. There was a gentleman by the name of Phil Robinson, who was the nephew of a man who had been an explorer. And he had been in Nubia, which is in Africa, Northern Africa, in 1881. And he, as an older man, related these stories to Phil, who wrote them down into a book. And in, he talked about this one called the Nubian tree, which had these beautiful aromatic flowers and this golden yellow fruit that looked like drops of honey. It was that amber color,
Mm-hmm.
And this awful plant would rear its death shade in the middle of the fern forest, and all kinds of vegetation grew around it. It constantly dripped dew, so it allowed all these other plants that needed moisture would come, kind of grow up against it, these large spiky plants and what have you. And supposedly this plant would lure animals in and then kill them, and it used a poison that would get on their coats when they would kind of reach in for the plant, to touch the plant. And then they would just drop dead. The dew from the plant, as I said, continued to drip all the time. And the tree, or this was its type of tree, the tree would capture the prey with its sharp branches pulling it in toward them, so that it would, catch the poison on it, take a step or two, and then the branches would pull it toward it and devour it. I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to formulate a response and got nothing.
when I started doing the research on this, I thought, oh, this isn't going to be enough for a podcast, but it's kind of cool. So I started doing the research on it. I ended up getting seven different podcasts out of that one afternoon of research. So there are others, but they're not all related to this subject, but just bumping into other things paranormal along that journey. But I want to talk about one that is called the vegetable serpent. This is a vine, okay?
Okay.
And it was reported first in 1852, and it was in an area of the rainforest in interior Africa, and it was actually where the original documentation came from, was something called Beachcombing's Bizarre History. And he talks about this plant. It was also noted in some journals from Italy, from some Italian explorers from earlier on, who also talk about this plant. And he talks about there's a link between animal and vegetable life, and that instead of a head, this plant had a flower and that looked like a bell, and carried on this liquid, and it was, so it'd be an upside down bell. And this plant wasn't rooted. It moved along the ground, pulling itself by its vines.
I can see how it got the name serpent.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And with the, flies, insects, things like that would smell this sweet juice and fly into it and get stuck on the sticky matter inside of it. Then the flowers would close and shut until they were devoured, whatever it had caught. It was large enough to actually suffocate lizards and things of that nature. So it was fairly large. And they would just digest them, and then it would open and spit out, if you will, the cartilage and whatever was not digestible. It would just kind of chuck it out. Mm. And, And it had these two openings in the flower itself, and that's what it would chuck them out through. And he describes it as it had a cartilage frame with yellow marrow. The natives considered this a delicious food if they could catch and kill one. And they actually talk about killing it.
Catching one though, that's the that's the part
I
that
think you cut off the vines.
Oh, okay.
And it was also, there was also another report of it, and it was called, this man, his name's Mr. Dunstan, and he calls it the devil's snare. And he describes it more as an octopus, like with tentacles moving all around. And his account is interesting. So he had been living in that area for about 2 years, and he's writing in his journal about this later. He had heard about this. He was in actually in Nicaragua, where he encounters it. And he had heard about this bizarre plant that they called the devil's snare. And so he convinces some of the natives to take him to the area. And while he's, they find the plant, and while he's looking at it, he has his dog with him. They've walked several days into the brush, into the bush, to do this. And he said it grows along the swamp regions near Lake Narikarga. And he's collecting plant and insect specimens to take back with him. Suddenly, he hears his dog give a yelp and a whine of terror. He turns around and he hurried to the source of the cries. The dog had gotten too close to this plant, and the dog was networked in a rope-like system of roots and fibers that moved and undulated. And it seemed like they exuded some form of liquid from its pores. It was gummy and thick, and like an adhesive, like a latex or something of that nature. And it had a foul odor. The dog was ensnared and struggling with this, trying, wailing, trying to get out, obviously in pain. Desperate to help his dog, Dunstan tries to cut the dog free with his knife, but he finds them difficult to cut. And to his horror, the plant's rope-like tentacles wrap around his hands as he's trying to get into it to cut it. And after enormous effort, he manages to cut free enough of the vines to pull the dog away. And he notices that anywhere that this liquid touched his hands, there's red blisters. And he said the dog was bloodstained and covered in spots as if it had been had puckered little suckers all over it, breaking open the skin and sucking out the fluid. He said the dog was alive, disoriented, and it was difficult for the poor dog to walk. He was a naturalist, and this was his expedition, and he had heard of this thing. He couldn't believe that it was for real. He tried to collect information, tried to collect a piece of it, and he said it was very difficult to approach or handle. And eventually, he drew photographs or drew pictures of it and tried to mark where he had found it, and decided that before somebody got hurt, the dog, he doesn't make any report of whether the dog survives or not, but before somebody gets seriously injured, he decided that he would pull up stakes and leave. And he said there, it was like there were tons of these little sucker bites all over the dog.
Wow.
And he said there was a lump of raw meat torn from his hand. He realized where he had been, you know, trying to cut that vining away. And he said it was as though this thing was literally drinking the blood. And he described it as very hard to get off. It latched on with little hooks or suckers and tried to actively attach him. He calls it, he said other people would call it the vampire vine. He had heard it referred to that way as well. So in 1874, a letter was written by a German traveler by the name of Karl Laik. He was writing journals, magazine articles, and what have you about his explorations. And he's traveling through Madagascar. Now, this is one of the most bizarre stories I ever heard. He wanted to go into the interior to catalog unusual plants. And so he talked to a local guy by the name of Hendrik, who was a European who had been living there for many, many years. He knew the whole area and most of the people. And he had been told that there was this group of cannibals on a secluded section of the island who would kill you. And they were called the Makotos. But there was also supposed to be very strange plants in that area as well. So he talks to Hendrik, and Hendrik says, hey, you know, the stuff about the Makutos is way exaggerated. They're not going to eat you. They're not cannibals. And I know them. I know some of them, and I'm pretty sure I can get you in there and out safely. So, yeah, I'll take you there. So he takes him into this area, several days walk into the interior. They come through this really bad swampy space and up to the Makoto village. And Hendrik's as good as his word. He does know them. And they're given sanctuary to sleep there, a mud hut to sleep in, and allowed to stay in for a while. And so they kind of settle in, and Lyke thinks that, you know, hey, this is cool. I'm going to get to chronicle all this, and I can go out in the daytime and gather these weird species of plants. And one day, the Makoto leaders come and gather everybody up. There's this big ceremony that's going to happen. And they march deep into the swamps there, and they come up to this tree. And it was a tree that they actually let Lyke and Hendrik go with them. And it was like a tree. He had never seen anything like it. He described it as pineapple colored with dark brown and hard as iron, about 8 foot tall. From the top of it, there were 8 gigantic stiff leaves, like doors that could swing on hinges, he describes them. He says they're 12 foot long and very thick at the base where they attach to the tree. And there's little tiny hooks on the leaves that are turned up like a cow's horn, like they stuck up in the air, like little cow's horns. And in the top of the trunk, there was an area of 8 leaves that all met together and a little white bowl shaped some sort of a structure. And it was filled with a sweet smelling liquid. There were 8 foot long hairy green tendrils that stuck out stiffly in all directions from the base of the bowl and kind of moved around. And they each had 6 white tendrils that sprouted at the base of the bowl and moved actively as though they were snakes, moving on their own, just waving back and forth the whole time. And the Makotos seemed to be intent on this tree. One of them drug a young woman up and at spear point put her up the tree, making her climb up and drink some of the fluid from the bowl. As she drank the fluid, she begins to pass out. And the white tendrils grabbed her, and the green tendrils wrapped around her, squeezing the life out of the poor woman. Finally, the great hooked leaves rose up and shut her like a vise. And I'm reading this from his notes, okay? Because a copy of his notes would later be published. And it says, squeezing the life out of the woman, and the hooked leaves rose up and shut her in like a vise. And soon both gore and sap were dripping down the trunk of the tree. At the sight of this, the Makotos leapt forward, catching the vile fluids in the variety of containers, or literally sucking it from the tree directly. As soon as they all had partaken, a horrible state of drunken broadiness fell upon them. And Lyke and Hendrik quickly left the scene. Over the next 10 days, Lyke kept checking back on the tree. On the 10th day, it reopened, and a white skull lay at its base. Lyke then explained that he had spent a total of 21 days exploring the area and examining 6 different species of trees, though none of the others were as large as the one that was washed up by the Makoto. And he said, I saw a playful lemur one day come too close to one of the trees, and it was seized, crushed, and wrapped so quickly it was snatched literally out of the air. This letter would then be sent, eventually would be published in newspapers around the country, around the world, actually. And I actually found a newspaper account. I have an account for, like, we can go in and look at old newspapers. And I actually found an account of the exact letter as it was written. So it was this story was so fascinating that in 1924, Governor Chase Osborne, who was the governor of Michigan at one time, published a book entitled Madagascar, Land of Man-Eating Tree. And he literally went to Madagascar and attempted to find this tree. He was completely convinced from the descriptions and all of the notes made that the tree actually existed. I thought it was just amazing. They talk about another tree, one more tree that we would like to talk about, and that is about a tree that was also in Japan, and this tree would literally wrap itself around a person. So it would, you would come up to the tree, it'd have these flowers on it, this great big bud. It sounded like it was about 4 to 5 foot tall. And as you leaned in to smell it or look at it, it would latch its branches around you, knocking you into this sticky fluid, and then wrap around you and kind of just digest you, and you couldn't get out.
And I'm suspecting that that process took a long time.
Yeah, I would say it would take a while for you to actually die from all of this. And during this process, I found out a couple things that were really fascinating. Going back to our little Venus flytrap, scientists believe that the reason anesthetics work for us is it messes with our sympathetic nervous system. Plants don't have one. Not like the humans do, not like vertebrates do. However, if you shoot up a Venus flytrap, and this doesn't happen for all other plants, but if you would expose a Venus flytrap to anesthesia, it will stop sensing as though it's asleep or numb, and the little hairs that trigger the plant to open and close don't work for at least 90 minutes. So in other words, it actually functions biologically like a vertebrae.
All right. So if you're going to go into an area where you have reports of those man-eating trees, put little ampules of propofol all over yourself.
I just thought this was really fascinating. As I said, there's so many of these stories.
Yeah.
And by the way, you were talking about the Little Shop of Horrors. That actually was the genesis for that was the story I told you about the woman who was forced up into the tree and devoured. That is the genesis for that showing up, because somebody had read that and added the crazy man-eating plants to the process.
And the voice of Levi Stubbs was done just because he sounded cool.
But yeah, I mean, for anybody who knows any stories that I might have missed, send me in that right direction. I will definitely look them up. But like I said, I pulled a lot of stories out and I was absolutely shocked at how many there were. And I probably walked away from another dozen because they were just repetitive, different places, but the same story over again.
All right. So now I'm going to put on my skeptic hat.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's how you have discourse, and that's how you know. With the proliferation the distribution, proliferation of cell phones and recording equipment, you know, why don't we have evidence of these kind of things? And you know, and again, don't think I'm trying to pick on you or anything like
no,
that.
But that's fine.
Why don't we have evidence? The same reason why we don't have many pictures of you know, Bigfoot or
right.
You know, dog men or other things. So. That may change, but I mean, they're just, everybody's carrying a recording studio around with them all the time now. Even people in countries where we traditionally wouldn't have thought that they would have such things. They're everywhere. Yeah. So.
But then people aren't going into those very, very remote areas as a general rule. You know, most people, tourists and what have you, they kind of stay in known areas. And there are stories. There are stories of dinosaurs in the Congo that have come forward since the 1940s. We thought the silverback gorilla was a myth until the early 1900s when one was finally captured. So the gild deer, which is a 4 foot tall deer, was found in Thailand? I think it was Thailand, several years ago. So the fact that we haven't found these plants isn't a huge shock to me if they are real. And I don't know they're real or they're not real. But the fact that we every year we're finding species of animals, and not all of them tiny things. You know, a 4 foot long deer with a tall deer with a gills in its nose is a pretty significantly large animal. But we didn't come across it until, you know, maybe 15 years ago. So I think there could be a couple different things. Obviously, they're in very remote areas. Like I said, most people don't travel into remote areas in Africa, Madagascar, places like that. They go and they do the tourist shtick. They just do. And South America is pretty much the same thing. There's all huge amounts of land. Even here in our own state, there's thousands and thousands of acres of land that probably hasn't seen a person in many, many years. So I don't know what's out there. Maybe one day we'll be shocked by what they find. They're finding things in the oceans that we didn't think were there, coelacanth and all kinds of other prehistoric things. So one day we may be visiting this subject again to say, okay, folks, they found this plant that's like 8 foot tall that could digest a person. But until then, be careful when you go in the woods. With that, I am done.
All right. Well, appreciate that. And you have yourself a good evening.
You too.